Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Alex Von Goldstein. We're going to be discussing conspiracy theories and the conspiracy movements. Alex, great talking to you again.
Always great to be on, Robert.
So conspiracy theories have been around quite some time. Basically, 9/11 is the birth of the modern conspiracy movement. And then before that, we had precursors, like there was the whole a militia movement of the 90s. And there's been conspiracy theories that have been around since like ancient times in the Middle Ages. But basically, 9/11 is a good place to start out with because it's sort of the birth of the modern day conspiracy movement. And
certainly,
my comment on this is because obviously the establishment and the mainstream media, it lies to people. But sometimes people have a tendency to say because the establishment lies, then they take it to the other direction. They believe everything that they get from maybe a conspiracy theory, and they blindly follow a conspiracy theory. So I think it's important to look at everything with a strong degree of skepticism, whether it's the conspiracy theories or the mainstream media.
Yeah, I take the same approach. Which can be challenging, because being dubbed a conspiracy theorist in a lot of ways is someone can easily negate your argument. You know, if you go on about something and you're not really going with the narrative or an acceptable counter narrative, and someone goes, well, you sound a lot like a conspiracy theorist. There's like you're two steps away from being a guy with a tin foil hat on screaming on the street at that point. So that's where the label becomes a bit challenging. And you see this with people like Pat Buchanan. You know he's a smart guy. I mean, he's a little bit with some of his social values and his traditionalist Catholicism can be a little bit not really for everyone. But I don't think Buchanan necessarily is a conspiracy theorist in the same way David Icke is. But just labeling that on Buchanan almost invalidates everything he says to like a normie.
Yeah. Well, Buchanan is not – I wouldn't say – he doesn't talk about like 9/11 truth or the Illuminati.
No.
Basically, he just talks about like basic populist views, how we have an elite that is going against the will of the people and they're pushing all these disastrous policies. I don't think that that's kind of a middle ground between the mainstream and conspiracy theories, and it's
but mainstreamers will still label that you'll still be labeled as a conspiracy theorist. Like if you're saying the government is not acting out in the interest of the people, and what you're saying is not going along with a media narrative, you will be labeled a conspiracy theorist.
Exactly, and then there's a sort of. There's different degrees of conspiracy theories. There's like the most extreme ones. There's like David Icke's lizard theory. Then there's this sort of general Illuminati theories. But then basically there's a sort of a populist theory, whether you want to call it a conspiracy theory or not, that the elites intentionally. Well, there's a theory. There's one kind of populist view that the elites are destroying the country out of greed. And then there's the view that the elites intentionally want to, like, loot the middle class and create a society that's a police state and an oligarchy. I think the elites want to achieve a lot of those goals, but not everything is, like, planned out in this vast conspiracy. A lot of things just happen. I think the truth is a combination of both.
Yes, yeah, certainly. I mean, these people, I think, you know, we've mentioned this before on our show, I think when we were talking to Rabbit, these elites, they don't think in they don't have a very long time preference. They don't view history in the same way that someone like Alexander the Great or Napoleon would. I think maybe Vladimir Putin does view history in the sense of like eons and like Russian civilization, and I think that's why he's so dangerous. You know, like to why the Atlanticists, as he would call them, leaders, really are afraid of him. I think it's because he views history in a super long-term way. But these people like, you know, David Cameron and Angela Merkel and Barack Obama certainly do not. These people are total materialists, and they view, you know, they're bureaucrats. And it, I think it's almost, you're almost giving them too much credit if you go on the, you know, Alex Jones bent with them and say that, oh, no, they're all, you know, these blood-sucking reptilians, even though it's more David Icke. But
I've noticed that Alex Jones has toned down his kookiness. I used
to
listen to him back in 2010. And if you want, if you're just looking for some laughs, I suggest doing a Google search, Alex Jones crazy rant, and he used to just really, like, sound like a total lunatic, but he's toned it down enough.
Yeah.
If you listen to his show now, for the most part, he sounds kind of almost like a populist conservative.
Yeah, it's
like
sort of like Breitbart-ish. Yeah.
Yeah, even like that. He's toned down, and he's. Also, I mean, he's become a multimillionaire, and I think he's reaching a larger audience. Like, he's appealing to a lot of the people, as you said, who post on sites like Breitbart. So he does.
Yeah.
He's had to tone a lot down.
Well, I also think that the world has become much more insane since, you know, the mid-2000s. I mean, there, you know, you had the Patriot Act and the Iraq War, but you... But in your day-to-day life, you could still ignore these greater things. You know, you can go from home to work to the bar and back, and not really worry about society at large. But I feel that now that we've entered into this phase of almost emotional communism and constant language policing, that people are skeptical and they are afraid. And Alex Jones can just essentially read the news in his gruff voice, and you know, people are like, "Oh my God, something crazy is going on!" But all he's just saying, he's just reporting on what he's seeing out his window.
I've also noticed that he's toned down his 9/11 stance. Originally, he was a hardcore 9/11 truther, like 9/11 was an inside job. 9/11 was an inside job. But
now he's basically saying,
going by what the 9/11 commission report said, that Al-Qaeda did 9/11, but that the Saudi government had a major role in financing.
Saudi Arabian government, they did not have a major role. Not a major role, they had the role. These are bad dudes.
Okay, there, yeah. So, yeah, exactly. But again, I still think that this, you have this hegemony, this, like, liberal hegemony, that we have all these phones and these, you know, streaming devices, and these apps, and when I walk down the street, all I see are people with their headphones on looking at their cell phones. And I see people walking around playing Pokemon Go. Like, I just see people that are on devices that are tracking them, you know? And, like, I don't believe that the elites are just, like, listening to our conversation and have files on me and you and are looking to lock us up in FEMA camps. I don't believe that. But, you know, at the same time, it's like the world has become completely, or at least contemporary American society has become very strange. We've had this huge technological accelerationism where the media plays such an important role in our day-to-day lives, and any dissenting voice is, like, thrown out immediately.
Well, I think 9/11 is worth going into because 9/11 was basically what started the sort of modern-day conspiracy movement. So
Definitely. There
was a lot of different theories. Obviously, first of all, it is true we were lied to by our government, but at the same time, a lot of these conspiracy theories were utterly insane.
Holographic planes controlled by reptilians from the planet Nereba?
Yeah.
UFOs? UFOs from alternate dimension?
So I don't really think our government did 9/11, but I think it's pretty clear that our government covered up for Saudi Arabia. That's obviously
what's
in the 9/11 commission report.
Yeah, there's something to be questioned You know, I mean, that's the thing. When you have a world, you have a massive event, when something like 9/11 occurs, and you just go along with what the government's telling you, without, I mean, look, I'm not going to go and jump to this holographic plane point of view. I'm not going to go jump to this controlled demolition narrative. I'm not going to go jump there. But I am going to question things, because when something happens that changes the course of human history, I don't think that one perspective on this topic, you know, that's hegemony. And I think hegemony is dangerous. You know, I like diversity of ideas.
Then there's also the theory that Israel did 9/11.
Oh, yeah, that it's that it's a Mossad operation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah, that's a whole... There's a whole ballpark there about, you know, Jewish conspiracy theories. And I think that the within the conspiracy movement, there's sort of three angles to it, and which is, it's either the reptilians, which has kind of gone out by the wayside. I mean, I think people sort of know that that's ridiculous. David Icke was pushing that forward in the mid-90s, and I don't think it really went anywhere. But after 9/11, people were really questioning things. And then maybe it was controlled opposition, you know? But that was thrown out.
One conspiracy theory is that conspiracy theorists like David Icke and Alex Jones are controlled opposition to make dissident movements look kooky. But that's
kind of kooky.
In its own right.
I mean, but I think that I don't really know if it's a conspiracy theory, that what you just said, but that definitely there is some kind of Hegelian synthesis on the within the eyes of like people that don't like us. You know, it's like somehow that worked out that when we talk about something, and then they'll be like, yeah, and the reptilians did 9/11. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like, it's just a way to discredit us. You know, like it something worked out. I don't think
or
that David.
You see...
David
you see that within a movement like the alt-right, like the more moderate segment versus the more like the 1488 types, and they both accuse each other of being controlled opposition.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, yeah, totally. So you have the kind of 1488 people saying that someone like Richard Spencer doesn't go, you know, quote-unquote, hard enough on the Jews, but then, you know, people that are in that kind of Richard Spencer camp, but we'll probably look at these 1488 types and think, well, obviously they're just extremists trying to make them look bad. But, you know, that's the problem if you're dealing with ideas that are not accepted within the liberal hegemony. You're going to have this huge level of paranoia that someone is trying to destroy the revolutionary idea from within. I think that's in any movement where you have people having a dissident voices, I think there's always this idea, this skepticism of are the people that are more extreme, are they the ones that are controlled, or are the people that are less extreme, are they the ones that are controlled? I think you're always going to have that dialectic.
And then you had the John Birch Society, the Birchers, who were popular back in the 60s. They were like a very kind of right-wing movement, and their conspiracy theory was that everything, communists were behind everything. Eisenhower was a communist. And then I've also heard a counter conspiracy to that, that the Birchers were controlled opposition, because what's interesting is that the Koch brothers were involved with the Birchers. And then I've also heard that they said that the communists were behind everything as a way to distract the American public from the role that the plutocracy plays. So there's that sort of origin. You see that on both sides going back and forth.
Well, an interesting thing is that, you know, I don't really believe any group of people, you know, regardless of who they are, if you have people who have an ideology and you put them in a room, you're still going to have discrepancies, you know? So that's the thing. It's hard to really generalize movements and say like the John Birch Society, because if you go on like Wikipedia and just look at a list of all the guys who participated in that movement, they're all pretty different, you know. It's like a big tent, you know. I think most movements are big tent movements. From the outside, they kind of seem like, oh, like the alt-right, like everyone who's on the alt-right is a you know, anime-loving, like this anime-loving neo-Nazi or something. But, you know, it's like a weird big tent thing, because people are going to consider someone like Steve Saylor alt-right. You know, some people will throw Steve Saylor in there. And he's like a dad who, like, likes golf course architecture, and he just, like, researches, like, HBD, and because he does that, apparently he's, like, a eugenicist Madison Grant type. But, like, you know, like, he's just, like, the whole thing is that anyone who's on the outside of a movement is going to view that movement as one thing, whereas the people that are inside the movement are going to view it as, like, a big tent, and they're going to try to basically – they're either going to embrace the big tent, or they're going to be like, no, we have to streamline ourselves, and they're going to just completely fall apart. Like, you know, wait, who's the Mossad agent here? Who's the reptilian here, you know?
Or another one I've heard is that I've also heard a conspiracy that both capitalism and communism are used as controlled opposition by the Illuminati.
Yeah, I mean that's I mean when you go into, I guess there's two kinds of conspiracies. There are the conspiracy theories that are drawn out of events, you know, like the Sandy Hook shooting, for instance. Like, okay, this didn't happen. Adam Lanza was an MKUltra operative, and the school didn't even exist, you know. And then there's, like, conspiracy theories that are rooted in greater ideas, like communism and capitalism are both controlled opposition. And I think the conspiracy theories in Group A, you know, like Adam Lanza or James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado, them being quote-unquote MKUltra operatives or whatever, it's a bit easier to talk about those things. Whereas I feel like going on tangents and saying, like, communism and capitalism are both controlled opposition.
They'll give an example, and this is also popular with this theory with, Jewish conspiracy theories that, like, both capitalism and communism are Jewish.
Sure,
like,
Jewish, Jewish invention,
point out that there were bankers financing communism, but one possibility is that that's absolutely true. Bankers did finance the Bolshevik Revolution,
definitely.
But doesn't mean that there's a vast conspiracy angle to it.
No,
it could very well
that
be
more or less has to,
that
yeah.
Bankers will finance everything because they're looking for a way to make a profit, and the communist revolution was desperate for the financing.
Well, sure, and also, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution was, you know, there's a Jewish element within that revolution, and perhaps some of these guys who were bankers, they cared more about their Jewish identity than they did money, you know? So, I mean, there's always that element. I mean, that's the dialectic in conspiracy. Is it a specific event? You know, like, are elites using specific events to make, you know, to create a larger narrative, or is it B, where it is like, and I think B is actually more feasible, where it's like, you know, the identities and group evolutionary strategies of people, you know, like there's a Western group evolutionary strategy in the same way that there is a Jewish group evolutionary strategy, and all these ideas sort of like coincide with each other and create tension and conflict, and that's sort of like human history. You know, it's like competing group evolutionary strategies. And I think, like, because we live in this post-enlightenment, post-modern world, it's, like, really difficult for us to understand, you know, cultural conflicts, because we want to be like Rodney King and just say, like, can't we all just get along? But, like, no, like...
Exactly, it's a
human
way...
Human beings exist, yeah.
I also think that sometimes conspiracy theories are used as a way to justify a position that would normally be politically correct. Sometimes it's more politically incorrect,
you mean, right?
Politically correct to put out a conspiracy theory than to say the actual angle.
Exactly,
one example
yeah.
of that would be the whole sort of a Rothschild thing. Like, people will say the Rothschilds as a opposed to saying the name of their ethnicity because they don't want to be seen as anti-Semitic. And I've also heard I've heard people actually who are in the mainstream say that those conspiracy theories are implicitly anti-Semitic, but in a lot of cases that's a valid argument. And with like 9/11 conspiracies and spree shooting conspiracies, I also think they distract from the root causes of those events. What causes terrorism? What causes mass shootings? Look at terrorism, Islamic terrorism in particular. Islamic terrorism is basically a product of this sort of invade the world, invite the world policy that we have.
Completely.
We're bombing all these Middle Eastern countries, engaging in a nation building, but at the same time, we let all these people into our countries. I mean, Europe has let in millions of Muslims, and we've also let some into the United States, so there's that angle. With the shooting theories about, conspiracy theories about James Holmes and Sandy Hook, I think in some ways, even though it's seen as kooky, it's more politically correct to say that like James Holmes was an MK Ultra than to analyze him and say what was his motive and what what about American society is churning out all these mass shooters?
Exactly. Like, what about American society makes people like Dylan Roof and Elliot Rodger and Adam Lanza and Chris Harper Mercer and James Holmes, like, what about our society makes these young men into sociopathic killers looking for revenge? Like, what about our society makes this happen? And I think the thing is that when you talk about the world in a negative way, when you look at the world and you say, no, there's something wrong with the way we're viewing, with the way we're going about our lives. You know, because it's funny, I feel like when I was younger, people were more critical of our cosmopolitan lifestyle in America. I think people were a bit more critical of our crass materialism and the way that we just, you know, kind of abuse ourselves. I think people were aware of this, that, you know, we're just eating fast food and playing video games. And, you know, and we've only gotten worse. You know, like I said before, you're just seeing people looking at their phones on Snapchat, going home and jerking off to disgusting porn videos, and going on Tinder and just swiping till they find some woman who's willing to fuck them, and then, like, having uncomfortable sex and going. It's like, no wonder all these people are on Prozac. And sometimes I think, like, people like me, this is like where I'm going to sound like Alex Jones. I feel like there's not that many, maybe there are, maybe we're a silent majority, as these Republicans like to say, but the people that are like, what the fuck is going on? You know, like the people that don't like this world. And when you're like, no, this is really bad, the way that people are living their lives, it's like, you're a reactionary. You're just a white male. You know what I mean? It's like these fucking people call me a white male, and then all the 1488 people are like, you're a Jew shill. So I'm like, I was talking to my friend. He's like, this is the problem with being mixed race, dude. What about me, you know?
So with these mass shootings, I think in some ways it's easier to say that, like, James Holmes, Sandy Hook, were all, like, conspiracy theories. I've also even heard people say that about Elliot Rodger because his dad was a producer of the Hunger Games. But I think that's an easier way out than actually saying that we have a sick society that is turning out a lot of sick people. Because then people will say that by doing that, people will say that you're blaming society instead of the individual, and then people will get all outraged and says, why are you excusing that person?
Exactly. But the thing is like, these people, they don't understand that society is fucked. You know, they feel that the only problem in our country is, like, white people being racist to everyone else. And, like, yeah, like, I don't like race. Like, I don't really like, you know, people being, like, crassly racist. It's really it's really gross to me. I mean, but at the same time, it's like, you know, like, I don't think, like, Charles Murray's books should be burned. You know what I mean? Like, at the same time, like, I feel like people should be inquisitive and skeptical about the world. And I feel like this idea that, like, the only people that can do anything bad are white people and everyone else is a hapless victim is the most pathetic thing I've ever heard in the entire world. So about us having this sick society, I think it's kind of interesting because we have all these movements like fat acceptance, for instance. So we're familiar with this idea of like fat acceptance. And I don't think that fat people, like, if I see a overweight dude walking down the street, I'm not going to, like, just say, ha ha, hey, fatty. Like, I'm not going to, I would never do that, you know? But at the same time, like, being overweight is really bad for your health. And Americans are having, there's a huge obesity epidemic, and people are dying, and they have, like, heart disease and stuff. And being overweight is not good. And it's like, because we live in this weird culture, like, you can't tell your friend who's overweight that they should, like, look into exercising without, you know, potentially seeming like an asshole. And I feel like people like us that are aware of this hegemony should maybe just start being assholes, because we're letting weak people have moral authority over us.
Well, there's these kind of contradictory strains in society. Like, you have, like, the whole, like, a fat acceptance movement, or the whole, all those different, like, SJW campaigns. But at the same time, it's this culture where people are expected to live up to these materialistic expectations. So I think there's a lot of that tends to make people, young people especially, be confused.
Yeah, it's sort of strange because, you know, there is this innate, I do believe that there is a way that we, you know, because we're biological, we're evolved apes, like, there is a way that our bodies want us to live our lives. And when we're not able to do that, or when we are able to do that, but we're told that doing that is bad, you know, just like being masculine, for instance, like, we're told it's bad. It's going to be confusing, like you said. But I think at the same time, there is this weird element within the SJW types where they mock the masculinity of the men who oppose them. So if you find SJWs annoying, it's like, oh, well, you're just a loser who masturbates to anime porn. It's like, if you don't like SJWs, it's like, well, you're just an angry guy who can't get a date or something. You know what I mean? It's like
it reminds me. Have you seen that meme of that's on a lot of those like red pill sites of I think it's like a cartoon feminist where they see like a nerdy guy and they're shouting at him misogynist, and then like a big tattoo neo-Nazi comes by and they're all like their pussies are wet.
Well, I mean, I mean, the whole thing is this, though. It's like that Nazi guy, though, he's going to look at that kid and just be like, oh, well, you know, you're a cuck or whatever. Because, you know, the men's rights, I mean, the men's rights people are just so strange to me, because they have a critique of feminism that basically is like, well, men don't have their own version of this ideology that they're opposed to. I find those people to be very strange. But when we, you know, take a step further and we look at, like, you know, if we're dealing with this culture war between the SJW types and the alt-right types, it's like the alt-right types are going to doubt the masculinity of men by calling them cucks. But then the SJW types are going to be like, oh, you called me a cuck. Well, you're, like, you know, we said a million times before, you're a loser who masturbates to anime porn and you can't get a date.
I noticed they don't call a guy a homosexual.
They don't call him a homosexual. No, they wouldn't be like, you're a fag or something. But I mean, that's the weird thing about the SJW types is like they're very puritanical, they're very Protestant, and they don't really use a lot of harsher curse words like cunt, fag, and pussy. So it's like when they're called those terms, it's almost like, you know, the world is being, you know, the ground is shaking and lava is coming out of the ground. If you just call someone a fag, it's like, oh my fucking God, do you know the etymology of that word? That word meant, you know, it's like, it's kind of, it's crazy. But, you know, again, like what I'm saying is I do feel like a lot of these ideological movements are kind of just based upon, like, you know, if we really go down to the core of it, it's like basic human survival techniques. And you know, I still think it's funny that you can't get away from this idea of masculinity. It's like unavoidable. And even when, you know, someone is like this guy who is the classic beta, the classic, I don't know, they call the beta cuck, you know, that kind of guy. That guy is still, like, you know, it's like I view these kind of guys and I see them as like they're so weird. Like, you know, if they argue with me, it's like they kind of want to be like, yeah, man, look, I don't believe in all the stuff that those people say. You know what I mean? But it's like, but you're a conspiracy theorist, they say to me. You know, it's like, dude, listen, man, all that stuff that those chicks are saying, yeah, it's bogus, man. I just kind of play around with it. But the stuff you're saying about, like, the government being not, you know, being bad and all this stuff, like, dude, come on. Like, we just need to reform it, man. Like, and they just talk to me about, like, Marxist economics and shit like that. Like, fuck that. But you know what I mean? I feel like I'm rambling.
Well, there's
also,
a kind of misconception that conspiracy theorists are all right-wingers, but there's left-wing conspiracy theorists as well.
Oh, God. I mean, left-wingers are conspiracy theorists, really, you know, like, and just as bad as right-wingers. I mean, that's why they're extremists, you know?
Could you say that their concepts of, like, white privilege or the patriarchy are conspiracy theories?
Oh, completely, completely. I mean, they're, look, if they're if that's a conspiracy, if the patriarchy is just as valid as David Duke, okay? Like, I put it at the same echelon of validity. So it's like, you know, men are controlling everything, they're making it hard for women, versus there is an over-representation of Jews in media and finance, and they make it harder for the Qayyum, then, yeah, like, I'll agree with both of those things.
So with,
like,
that,
I'm a feminist now. Because I don't think women should be in the kitchen bare feet. Like, I don't think that. I think that some guys, like, that are uber-reactionary against crazy feminists are like, no, well, women need to fit in their traditional roles. But, like, no, I don't – I mean, women are capable. I mean, like I said before, I think a lot of people should just, like, raise families. But, you know, I'm not, like, this anti-woman guy.
Then you brought up an interesting point, is the argument about white privilege is really no different than someone like David Duke's argument.
Yeah. I think that people want to blame outgroups. It's like, you know, like within social identity theory, there's this idea of like the in-group and the out-group. And what like intersectional feminism does is it takes this like globalist view of like women of the world and pits them as the in-group and pits them against the out-group of men of the world. And that's almost what's happening in a lot of these other kind of like Marxist movements that you see in colleges that are using, like, you know, critical race theory and whatnot, is it's all non-white people are the in-group and white people are the out-group. Or like,
and that's
more specifically
always been,
yeah,
the case throughout history. Human beings are inherently tribal, so you've had these conflicts throughout history. And it's always been your tribe is the good guys, and the other tribe is evil. And
exactly.
Obviously, like 1488ers view Jews as being evil, and SJWs view anyone who is some even like borderline pro-white as evil. So you see that mentality that the other side is evil.
They view white people. They just view white people as being evil. Like, even the allies.
Unless,
like, you can go,
unless they go way out of their way to debase themselves. But even then, in some cases, like, they're still evil.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you'll read these things in Huffington Post or Salon where it'll be like, you know, some like super libtard writer just going off about like, you know, like, I'm an activist, I care about people, but I am still a racist. Like, I have to atone at the church of Martin Luther King's anti-racism every day. And that's like, I mean, it's weird because, like, you know, like Heath Preston has said to me and you, like, this is a religion, you know, like, and I saw it on, like, I was watching, like, you know, CNN, like, I saw, like, Don Lemon's show. There was a guy on who, you know, a black intellectual guy who was saying that anti-racism has become a religion for white people. And the weird thing is, like, I saw a poll online that said, like, I can't remember it exactly, but it was like a good amount of black people prefer All Lives Matter to Black Lives Matter. But what I'm saying about this whole church of anti-racism thing is that I feel like in a lot of ways it's very condescending to black people. It's like these white liberals, like Paul Gottfried says, and I said this a million times on this podcast, but Paul Gottfried said that these white swipples, they view black people like sacred objects. And I've literally, I've seen white kids on the internet say, like, black lives are sacred. And there's this idea, like, they view black people as, like, not human. Like, they view, like, it's very, like, I find it to be very weird and, like, condescending. Like, it's very strange that they view black people as almost like, I feel like they view them like they're pets or something. And they're, like, other white
and a lot
people,
of these
right,
are individuals who don't even have any black friends or even
exactly.
acquaintances.
No, and they live in all white communities too. So it's like they have this kind of idea. I mean, they have this idea of like, oh, I've been so grateful my whole life to never have to deal with you know, violence or anything like that. Or they would never even use a word like violence. They use Marxist terms like oppression.
So there's this sort of concept of the green pill, and the green pill can be used to describe conspiracy theories and kind of also new agey stuff. But I think what's interesting about the contrast between that and the red pill and the iron pill is that the red pill is purely materialistic, or for the most part materialistic. A lot of it is the red pill is about what can we do to make our ethnic group more powerful? What can I do to get more sex? How can I become more masculine? Or the iron pill is all about being more physically strong. And the green pill is not, what's interesting about it is that it's not materialistic. It's not traditional religion. It's not Christianity. But at the same time, it is. The whole concept of the green pill is that there is this like otherworldly aspect, and that could include, as I said, a conspiracy theorist who literally believe that there's these like lizard race of lizard people ruling everything, and also includes there's people who are interested in like different there's like LSD and there's like drugs like peyote. Or people are just craving these, or like these different sort of otherworldly and outer body experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the green pill is almost like the acid laced version of the red pill. And I think while the red pill takes place firmly amongst historical narratives of human beings on this planet, the green pill sort of brings things into like a trans-dimensional trans-dimensional perspective. It's sort of like the universe, and you know, people will sort of go into these ideas of multiverses and parallel dimensions and all these crazy things. And you'll notice that these are people that are that believe that spiritual forces exist within the world, and I think they're more than likely going to be tied to like the idea of the Illuminati controlling the world, or even in a crazier sense, reptilians from the fifth dimension controlling the world. Like this idea that things are under control, like the true spiritual revolution could not occur because You know, the elites are sucking up all of the magic juju, you know, like even Alex Jones kind of goes into this territory where he'll be like, the Washington Monument is like this giant dick that's like sucking up all our energy and giving it to like, you know, people at Bohemian Grove.
Some of them will say that they're more like traditional Christians, but they'll say that the elites are occultist and believe in all this.
Or satanic, yeah.
Yeah, they literally believe the elites are satanic.
I mean, I was listening to Lou Rockwell on Alex Jones, and I feel like Lou Rockwell is like has a pretty like solid head on his shoulders. Like, I don't really feel like he's that loony. You know, I think Alex Jones is kind of loony. I feel like Lou Rockwell is like a kind of bread and butter guy, but he was going on about Bohemian Grove on Alex Jones, saying that these elites, like, they go to Bohemian Grove and they engage in like mock child sacrifices. And the thing is, it's like, well, maybe they're going there and they're just doing that. Maybe they're not, you know, plotting the world, you know, like plotting the future of the world, like saying, okay, this person's going to be president. Let's go in the bloodlines and see who we can pick next. Like, I don't really believe they're doing that, but yeah, like, I think they could be engaging in, you know, mock child sacrifices and possibly worshiping the god Moloch. You know, they have like this owl statue. I mean, I don't think that they're doing it. I don't think that they believe in Moloch in a metaphysically, in a sense of like metaphysical objectivity. I don't think they believe in him in that way. But Moloch represents Carthage. And when Sigmund Freud would write in his notebooks, you know, his diaries, he would compare himself to Hannibal and would say that his psychoanalysis was like the equivalent of Hannibal's attempt to destroy Rome. So I do think that that our elites that go to Bohemian Grove, even though I sound like a total tinfoil head, I mean, these people are dancing naked in front of Moloch. Like, they're not sitting in a Protestant church. You know what I mean? Like, they are interested in decadence. And when you live in a society that is run by people who believe in decadence, you're going to get a decadent society.
I think people are kind of – people crave spirituality and they crave that otherworldly experience. But a lot of people find mainstream religion to be boring. So they look for some kind of alternative to either just regular life and to mainstream religion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can be interesting way of looking at things. I also kind of agree with Slavoj Žižek on this point in that the truth is disgusting. Like, there is an absolute truth that one can feel within them. And I think that a lot of these SJW types are just practicing in self-deception because they know the kind of brutal, harsh, disgusting truth. And I feel like, in a weird way, something like the green pill, though what I think it's super fun and super interesting, is a way to kind of dilute yourself from a real, more visceral, objective, empirical truth. And I think you can see this delineation between, like, Henry Harpending, the guy who's, like, the human biodiversity researcher, his book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, that he wrote with Gregory Cochran, that was about the explosion in human IQ from like a genetics perspective. And if you look at that on one side of the dialectic and then on the other side you see Terence McKenna saying like, oh, the reason why this happened is because a monkey ate a magic mushroom that expanded his mind, you know, that just gives stoners an excuse to have fun with psychedelic drugs. You know, it's obviously not, I mean, people like Grant Hancock going on about immaterialism, yeah.
It's a way to kind of avoid studying like HBD.
Exactly. I mean, the weird thing is like I've spent a considerable amount of time of my life around Southeast Asian people who are very into HBD. You know, like these people are, I mean, a lot of, especially like Korean people that I've, you know, talked to at college are very interested in HBD. I think there's something to be said about like white Protestantism and universalism that makes things like HBD unavoid topics that people really want to avoid.
And then there was this a debate between Graham Hancock and Richard Dawkins. And this is about sort of the concept between the concept of materialism and the idea of the truth. So there's spirituality versus rationality. Graham Hancock, is he kind of like a hippie type who's into like LSD?
Yeah, he's into like DMT. That's like the big thing. I remember a couple of years ago, I think that there was this like burgeoning drug movement. I mean, I don't really know if it exists anymore. There was a bit of this kind of like the artist Alex Gray, you know, he does like stuff for Tool album covers. And I just knew kids that were like taking like research chemicals and like taking DMT, and it was all about kind of like breaking on to the other side and stuff. But now like all those people are just like total cookie cutter SJWs. So it's like, you know, people listening to this show, like, if you want to go out to the Amazon and, like, meet some shaman and take, ayahuasca, like, yeah, sure, go ahead. But I really don't think it provides you with the level of enlightenment that, Joe Rogan says it's going to give you. I feel like you'll get a much higher level of enlightenment just reading Steve Saylor's blog on Un's Review. I feel like read Steve Saylor. You know, don't take drugs. the only pill you need is the Saylor pill.
Maybe those experiences don't give people maybe they don't give them knowledge about the physical world, but people are just, I think human beings sort of naturally crave something otherworldly, and there's like rationalism.
Certainly.
He is analyzing science and society from a logic-based background, and that's...
And if you don't have autism, it can be kind of difficult to be like that. You know, like, I last summer, like I talked to you about in the first interview we did, I'd gone through some, you know, periods of depression, and I realized, like, I was viewing the world the wrong way, you know, and I was
like,
okay.
So you were, like, full-blown black pill?
I was full-blown black pill. I was kind of like purple pill for like most of my life, and then I went black pill like early last year. Like I just lost it. I couldn't handle it anymore. And then I just became like super rationally minded, and like just super fucking logical, like fedora kind of thinking. And like I'm not that kind of guy, but I'm like not that kind of guy. So then I've just, like, you know, gone on these, like, weirder directions, just sort of, like, trying to, like, be a truth seeker and, like, ask questions and, like, keep going further.
Because the real world is painful, people want to create this their own world as a sense of escapism.
Yeah, and I also don't think there's something completely wrong with that. Like, I think that the truth, in a lot of ways, doesn't really matter, you know. I think that people are going to develop their own truths, and you know, like I said before, I kind of believe in localism and communitarianism. Like I think that the truth amongst your like direct tribe of people you associate with is a bit more important than trying to fit into society at large, especially in this awful cosmopolitan mysticism that we all live in today.
What do you think about the whole concept of solipsism as basically saying the world only exists as you see it?
I think for some people that might be a better approach, especially if you're a real, real high IQ type. Like if you have like a 170 IQ and you're like a genetics wizard, I feel like that person should be solipsistic. They should just focus on their research because they could find some really amazing things. And if they spent all their time out with other people who would be pushing them in different directions, their research would never really go nowhere. So I think some people, you know, maybe the more artistic amongst us are the super rational, super high IQ types. I think those people, it might not be that bad to be maybe just a little solipsistic. Because it would be good to focus on their own worldview because they have something to provide to other people that may be shocking, that may be strange. But, you know, the great thinkers of human history, especially of, you know, the European civilization, you know, like a Goethe, you know, or like a, someone like Goethe, you know, like he didn't, these people are, or Schopenhauer, you know, these people did not, or Nietzsche. Nietzsche did not have an easy life, you know, these people did not have good lives.
Were like recluses.
I mean, look at Van Gogh, he's a classic example. We're taught, you know, even in public school that, you know, that these great thinkers were recluses that had crazy ideas that society didn't accept, and then they died and people went and found their notebooks and said, oh great, we got to publish this. This person was a genius. So, you know, I think that's, you know, we live in this crazy hegemony, especially with the social media, where we're expected to put our diaries out, you know, and shoot out our diaries to the world. But, you know, I think that, yeah, I don't think we have to, I don't really think we have to give a shit about other people sometimes. You know, I think we need to speak the truth, and that's probably what people need. You know, our idea of the truth, I should say.
On the topic of conspiracy theories, A while back I interviewed Andy Nowicki. He wrote a book about, I think it's something like conspiracy control and compliance. And he takes a sort of a similar approach that we do about conspiracy theories.
Exactly.
He makes the case
I really like the way Andy looks at conspiracy theories.
Is he doesn't take them literally, and he's reluctant to come out and endorse them, but he uses them as analogy. So one example is he uses David Icke's reptile theory as not in a literal sense, but more that you have people in positions of power who are basically,
yeah,
I guess the word would be like
cold-blooded, yeah.
And
yeah, sociopathic, exactly. I mean, I was listening to Andy talking about the Orlando shooting, and, you know, and the thing I love about Andy Nowicki is that he approaches every topic with a lot of sense. Like, he doesn't jump 100% on, like, it was, you know, it was this, or, you know, it was that. Like, he was talking about the Orlando shooting when the Afghan guy, Omar Mateen, shot up the Hispanic gay nightclub Pulse. You know, he said, well, how do we even know that this happened? And while most normies would scoff at that, I think that, yeah, like, I don't know, I think that that's worth asking. Like, every time you see these events, like Sandy Hook or the Aurora, Colorado, the Batman shooting, there's a lot of questions and there's a lot of conflating narratives. And then there's people who, you know, say, oh, no, they're crisis actors. Because, you know, to sort of go somewhere with this, I think that, look, like, the media is reporting on all of these events, and the media is constructing a narrative of these events. So even if they happen, which I'm sure they do, I mean, I think, I don't want to disrespect the families of the departed, I'm sure that these events happened, but it's obvious that the media is going to reshoot things, they're going to, you know, they're making films, you know, like, if TV is not reality, they're filming things, they're framing things. So, you know, I feel like it's very healthy to question things. Like, yeah, you don't want to go 110% that the shooting is just some way for the government to figure out a way to take away guns. But I also think we have to keep in mind the objective fact that the media is creating a narrative. And they are
showing videos. The truth is always somewhere in between. It's somewhere in between the mainstream narrative and the most outlandish conspiracy theory. It's just determining like how close it is to which one. And it also could be some conspiracy. Obviously, anyone who believes every single conspiracy theory is insane. But
I want to try to be that guy. Just believe in every single conspiracy.
I'm sure at least some of them have a significant degree of truth to them.
Yeah, I mean, and the weird thing is, you always, you know, like the Gulf of Tonkin being a false flag event or whatever. This information is released long after anyone kind of gives a shit. So that's the other problem with this, is that we see throughout throughout our you know, American history, we see all these sort of strange things that have happened involving the government, but the information is only released once it's enough time has passed and people don't have that initial kind of biological reaction to it, you know?
Did you see that documentary I sent you on YouTube? It's titled Hollywood Casting Couch, Satan's Playground, and the premise of it is that...
I haven't watched it, but yeah, I'm familiar.
All these celebrities, they're blackmailed through these weird sexual rituals. A lot of them involve, like, homosexuality, pedophilia, and just really are, like, bizarre, just the most bizarre things you can think of.
Well, that was strange, because that was there was a weird, like, SJW boycott, you know. It's funny, the alt-right will want to boycott movies, like, boycott Ghostbusters. alt-right says, boycott Ghostbusters, because women can't defeat ghosts, and boycott Star Wars 7, because it's miscegenation in space. And the SJWs will say, you know, to boycott. They might actually have a bit more. I might give it to them on this one, where Bryan Singer, the director of X-Men Apocalypse, he was involved in these kind of young boy sex cult things, where he, you know, they bring all these young men in and have sort of weird sexual liaisons with them just to give them all jobs and whatnot. But I do think that that's kind of there are some weird elements there, because
there's people exchanging sex for different things, but this documentary, it takes it further than that. It really,
that there's an occult angle to it or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, the weird thing here is Stanley Kubrick's film Eyes Wide Shut, which I love. I love that movie. Eyes Wide Shut is basically about that, because Tom Cruise's character, he gets sort of sucked into this underbelly of elite sexual orgies. And when he goes to Sidney Pollack's house, and Sidney Pollack knows that Tom Cruise was the guy who infiltrated the event, he says, if I told you the names of the people who were at that party, you would shit your pants. So it's implying, you know, that there are really big shot people that go to these weird sexual orgies where there's sacrifices and whatnot, and this ties things back to Bohemian Grove.
Because
one conspiracy
theory that I've heard put out is that they blackmail politicians by having them do either things that are humiliating or even doing things that are sexually illegal, and then videotaping it, and if they get out of line, putting it out there. That's a common, I've heard that from, like, Alex Jones.
Yeah, there is this, I mean, you know, and then there was the whole David Cameron put his dick in a pig's ear or mouth or whatever. That, you know, and then Brexit happened. so maybe Alex Jones is right about that one. But you know, just keeping this, you know, going back to the Eyes Wide Shut, it's funny because, you know, we have this whole idea of Hollywood being run by these pedophile sex cults. And I think there's this idea that it kind of exists in, like, the red pill people, because, you know, Hollywood, you know, these directors are a lot of them are Jewish. It's, you know, Jews sort of trying to infiltrate the minds of, you know, these white people. But on the other side of it, these green pill types, the green pill people, they sort of embrace the Frankfurt School. They embrace Adorno, and they embrace Wilhelm Reich. And they, because, you know, Adorno warned of, like, this culture industry of film and media just kind of consuming reality. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing, where I think a lot of people on the alt-right, if they read Adorno, they'd probably end up agreeing with a lot of what he says about the dangerous impact of media.
People go to see films because it does... They're craving this otherworldly experience outside their own mundane lives.
Sure, and I feel like, you know, before Star Wars, like, you know, there's the film The Conversation, the Francis Ford Coppola movie with Gene Hackman. It's a really good film, but it's pretty cut and dry, you know? But if you were going to the theater, or the Godfather, everybody went to the theaters to see the conversation, and everyone went to the theaters to see the Godfather, you know? And even something like Jaws, which I think Jaws is overrated, but it's still like an interesting film. I mean, and even, you know, Taxi Driver. I love Taxi Driver, and people went to the theaters to see these films. But I feel like but what I was saying is that, you know, in the late 70s, you had Star Wars came out. And Star Wars in 1977 kind of changed the game. Where, I mean, I think Star Wars is actually a pretty good movie. I think it's good. It's like hero's journey. It sort of feels like ancient in a lot of ways. And I like how Lucas kind of tied it to like Kurosawa, Japanese samurai. There's interesting things in Star Wars.
It's like it's kind of retro futuristic in a sense.
Yeah,
even.
Hell yeah. I mean, Star Wars 1 is amazing. But the thing is like that opened the door for Hollywood to be like, okay, we don't need to put all our money into movies like publicizing things like The Godfather. And then you had like Heaven's Gate, Michael Cimino's film, which is one of my top movies of all time. I love Heaven's Gate. It's a really interesting movie about like Eastern European immigrants, basically dealing with life in the like the Midwest in the late 1800s. I think it's beautiful. Like I tears come out of my eyes when I watch that movie. I love Michael Cimino. I love that movie, but that movie failed miserably at the box office, and it got terrible reviews because it just like destroyed United Artists. And then like when you look into the story of Heaven's Gate, you basically see how the Hollywood, the film industry is tied directly to like the newspaper industry, to the media industry, to the people that are reviewing the films. You know, certain movies
a comment Rabbit made on a previous show is that Hollywood has become just sort of extremely the more profit driven it becomes. Like back in say the 60s, 70s, 80s, they were a drive for profit, of course, but there was still a sense of a strive for creativity. Now it's gone to the point that I think most movies, they have this like formula, and they're just looking at it. It's purely for profit, and there's
I definitely think that the late 70s was the time where this really changed. Because if you look at the top grossing films of the 1970s, and you compare that to the top grossing films of the 1980s. There definitely is a shift in quality, I would say so. And I think the same goes for music. I mean, I know James O'Meara was saying we shouldn't bash the 80s, and I agree with him. I think there's so many great things that have come out of the 1980s, you know. But the thing is like, you know, when Peter Frampton released Frampton Comes Alive, which I think was like 77 as well, the record companies realized how much money they could make off of, you know, just generic pop music. You know, that's where your Joni Mitchells would just get thrown out the window. You know, your people are
also
making interesting music. You don't need them anymore if you can make money with Peter Frampton.
There was that film, They Live, and it kind of uses conspiracy theories, or like it's sort of similar almost like the lizard theories of space aliens to make a sort of social commentary.
Yeah, I mean, I think that They Live is, my God, I think that's a movie that every dissident thinker needs to watch and use as a metaphor, because that's essentially what being, you know, red-pilled is. I mean, it's like when you just start looking at the world in an analytical fashion and start doubting the media, you know, hegemony. I mean, and not going into some crazy Alex Jones reptilian place, but just doubting what's happening. That you basically have the sunglasses on. You're basically John Nada, and you're walking around with the sunglasses on. And I think John Carpenter, who directed They Live, is someone who is probably a conspiratorially minded guy. Because he said like he originally wanted to make westerns, and when you watch his movies, and I even think like his late 90s movies like Vampires with James Woods and Ghost of Mars, I actually think those are awesome movies because they're like they're like westerns, but they're like revamped as like insane like horror movies. And like, I think there's something really cool about that. But like the western in itself, like as an idea, is something that is like inherently masculine, inherently like traditionalist, and like skeptical of government and like elitist in a way. You know, you have like the tough dude, and he like rises up. And I think that like, and you know, They Live has like those elements of the Western in them as well. And I think it's kind of funny that, you know, the genre is called the Western when so many people in our sphere, as big as it is, are all focused on this idea of like a Western identity or whatever. It's like, yeah, well, we could probably learn something from like watching, you know, John Ford movies as well as, and I definitely think John Carpenter too.
We're basically out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add, kind of to summarize up these topics?
Well, I think what we said before is that it's healthy to remain skeptical. Like, you know, you have an option to just turn on the news and just go along with whatever narrative. And you're kind of told, like, what your reaction should be, especially when you go on social media and you see the way everyone else is reacting. It's like, well, I'll just go along with the hegemony. Or you can decide to become skeptical. And I think that, you know, it's very good to be skeptical, and it's very good to be skeptical with some sense. Like, you don't need to dogmatically believe in your conspiracies in the same way that these normies believe in their liberal hegemony and their media. You don't need to believe in it in the same way they do. But you also need, I think, being skeptical and having sense is the best way to live your life, especially in these very strange times.
So, Alex von Goldstein, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thanks a bunch, Robert. It's always great.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.